Good evening and happy Shabbat. I'm certain I'm going to regret this, but I woke up this morning to all things Muhammad. You see, there was a fellow named Muhammad that last night cold-cocked his brother. His brother called 911 and wanted to have the police come because of a battery, but when the police showed up, they said, I'm not going to charge my brother. So 15 minutes later, the brother, whose name was Muhammad, cold-cocked his father. And so they called 911 again, and this time a female deputy showed up, but she didn't even get to the door. Walking up the stairs, Muhammad, with an AK-47, fired four rounds into her. And then Muhammad, for good measure, turned on the door to the apartment and shot his father. And so that was my morning with Muhammad being Muhammad. And then today, I don't think it's possible today to watch any program on the news or on sports and not just hear how wonderful Muhammad Ali was. God, it just makes you want to puke.
Yeah, I rented the fire.
Everything I've heard about Muhammad Ali, that with exception of being an egotistical fighter, you know, being a fighter does not put one high on my priority list, nor God's. And being egotistical to an extreme, the fact is that he converted to Islam because he was a racist. Initially, in his life, he might have gotten over that. I understand he died a pretty nice fellow, but can you imagine a person who is stupid enough to convert to Islam? He began by saying, I've chosen the name Muhammad because it means deserving of all praises. And Muhammad was a pedophile, a rapist, a kidnapper, a thief, an armed robber, a sexual pervert, deserving of all praises. Yeah, indeed. Boy, how could you be stupid enough to not only do that, but then have everybody in the media talk about how wonderful an example he was for America about Islam, and he's having an Islamic funeral now. I'm not sure that made me feel better, but at least I got it off my chest.
Well, you know, I mean, they got a rabbi out there that, I mean, this guy could give the Pope a run for his money. He was obviously a queer. He was a communist. And he claimed that Jews are marching arm in arm with Islam today.
Right.
I mean, this was the speech this guy gave. I was blown away. I mean, he was so delusional, weird, political, strange, that in my opinion, he and the Pope should get together and do some spooning. This is just,
you know what the single most pro homosexual city is in the world?
No, I don't.
Tel Aviv. Really?
Wow. That surprised me.
Yeah, single most pro homosexual. You know, there's something about being at odds with God, thinking you're smarter than God, being the land of three perverted religions, plus socialist, secular, humanism, four, let's throw in communism. And it just goes, the worship of man goes all the way to the point where men start having sex with men.
And very weird.
It is pretty weird.
Very, very.
You know, I didn't get any hate mail this week on anything we said last week. You know, so that's always a good start. Kirk, we're going to turn to the justification for the New Testament, particularly about Paul. But I really would like to finish Chabaouk tonight, because we've got two chapters of material on Yashaya, Isaiah, chapter 1, chapter 2. Really interesting as God begins with his most, you know, comprehensive prophetic portrayal, the way that he begins in Israel and what he has to say about the children of Israel and about religion. And then we're going to take an interesting detour into the life of Dode and of Solomon, and right after that, and then we'll return back to Yashaya. So we got a lot of ground to cover. You guys have anything you want to talk about before we jump back into Chabaouk?
Let me tell you what you guys said about Ramadan. Is Ramadan this month?
Yes, it is. Yes, it's
currently this is
right now.
This is what I read on the internet about Ramadan.
By the way, when you say it's Ramadan this month, you got to be
because
careful.
I don't know which
Muhammad
month it
is. Muhammad was so stupid. You know, Muhammad was absolutely so stupid that what he said is the intercalary month that was established, you know, by the Babylonians. It's Yahweh has an intercalendar month. If he used the moon, which the world did for better part of 5,000 years of recorded history as the mechanism to keep track of time, no matter where you might be, the moon phases were the perfect way to do that. But with the intercalendar month, you can be accurate to the to precision on
the seasons.
Solar, yeah, to the seasons, to 365 and a quarter days per year. It's an extraordinary mechanism. All you have to do is you add a month every 2 to 3 years based upon the timing of the first crescent moon in the spring, and its timing from barley bean Abib, or basically from the spring equinox. But Muhammad, being stupid as a stone, said, oh, no, that stuff is of Satan. And so we're just going to, you know, the moon is a perfect timepiece. So to preclude the months from meandering aimlessly around the year, we're going to eliminate it. And so what do you have in Islam? The months just wander aimlessly around the year. So this year, yes, Ramadan is being celebrated now. But next year it'll be celebrated at a different time.
Well, that's why I asked, because I can't even remember when exactly.
Yes, yeah, do you know what the basis of Ramadan is?
Isn't that when he goes into the cave and gets possessed
that
by a
demon? That's correct. Muhammad was out being a pagan. He was following, he had nothing else to do. I mean, he had no job. He had nothing going on. So Muhammad was out being a pagan, and he's doing the pagan fasting in the month of Ramadan per the pagan religion that is practiced by the idiots in the little mud hut town of Mecca. And while he's out there, he's a very dark, demonic spirit meets with him in a cave and beats him to a pulp. And the experience is almost identical to Paul's experience of the road to Damascus, except Paul happened in the middle of the day, where this one happened in the middle of night. They both had exactly the same kind of experience with the spirit, and the same kind of nonsense came out of the spirit's mouth. Is the moment Muhammad said, listen, I tried to commit suicide, I have been demon-possessed, and then he said that the spirit said, Kara, which is, which he interpreted as read, and he says, I'm illiterate, I can't read. Of course, Kara is a Hebrew term. It's one of the most important of all Hebrew terms. It means to invite, to summon, to call out, to meet, to read, and to recite. And so he's claiming that he's getting this Quran revelation in pure Arabic. And, of course, the word that formed the first word is, in fact, Hebrew. In fact, the alphabet that would form Arabic later is also Hebrew. He's having this experience that he says that that he's supposed to read this, that he's illiterate, and that man was created from a congealed clot of blood. Well, congealed clot of blood is dead blood. That ain't how we were conceived.
No.
Now, you would have thought...
Well, science doesn't disprove this.
That the moment that somebody with the least modicum of education read the first revelation, by the way, it's not the first revelation because the Quran is a screwed up mess. It's in the 96th surah. You think that this is a moron that came up with this? What drivel? And yet, Muhammad Ali is being praised for choosing Islam. So, yes, it is. To answer your question, yes, Ramadan is being celebrated right now.
Okay.
So what do you say about
that? Well, knowing all that as backdrop, I read the latest Big Cheese Muggity Muck Imam, who gave the party line from Ramadan, and he goes and talks through the fasting and so forth. And he said, here's his rationale. He said that the prophet was said to have brought out, this was Ramadan, was said to have brought out his the most altruistic nature in the prophet by experiencing Ramadan. He became most generous in this month by keeping himself away from all the delights of the world. And that sounds like
words,
Moses.
He couldn't
indulge in
his little children that were part of his harem.
Mm-hmm. And that's why we should all do Ramadan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there you go. He said that the Balaam prophet, that would be the prophet of the Lord, that cursed Bnei Israel, the children of Israel. Guess what the name of the location was, just on the other side of the Yarden River, that he hailed from?
Something another Allah, if I'm not
You mistaken. Got it. Hailed near Allah.
Yeah.
How about that for interesting? All right, well, you know, it is astonishing that 1.2 billion people profess an allegiance to a religion to the point they'll kill for it and are belligerent when you criticize it. That was conceived that is that utterly stupid. But it's hard to top stupid when you carry around a book that has the prophet Chabauk in it, along with your goddamn New Testament. And in the book of Chabauk, there's a detailed condemnation of Paul. And yet you carry around that same book, 13 letters from Paul. Now, that's pretty stupid.
Mm-hmm.
That is what they call it.
Most people don't even bother to read Chabauk.
Yeah, it's an intellectual disconnect. So why even bother to carry around the book if you're not going to read it?
Well, I think you said that before. It's just a lot of extra weight you're packing around. And, of course, the way they copy-edited it, you couldn't make heads or tails of it anyway. So why not? I mean, they don't know anything.
It looks really impressive. Anything.
I guess it looks impressive. They can say it's the inerrant Word of God, except we don't know God's name, except we wrote God's name out of it. Starting with 13, which was two verses before we left off the last time, why don't you look here and pay attention? You know, he's talking about the idiots that have been beguiled by Paul. Why don't you look here and pay attention? By means of association with Yahweh, of the conscripts who provide assistance, and we talked about why Yahweh associates himself with the Sabah, which is that as a seven-dimensional entity, he has to engage with us through implements, just as well.
Yeah, it would be like us trying to participate in a book we wrote, like you pointed out. You know, I mean, Walt Disney would have to paint his picture into a comic book to deal with Mickey Mouse.
Walt Disney used implements. He used paintbrushes and pencils and pens. Those are the implements he used to engage in a lesser dimensional world. So it's Yahweh of the Sabah. He has to have spiritual implements to engage in our
And that tells us, by the way, right away, that God is not on the planet. Yahweh is not
on the
planet.
Otherwise, he would not tell you that he's of the conscripts who provide assistance. There'd be no reason for him to say that.
Right.
And by the way, if all of God could fit onto this planet, then there's not enough of God to create the universe. There's not enough God to create the planet. There's not enough God to create anything.
You have an energy.
Much less a universe with 400 billion galaxies, each averaging about 100 billion stars. But if you're, by the way, if you're in the seventh dimension, you're creating a six-dimensional universe, you could do it with absolute and total
minimal effort.
Minimal effort. Now, I happen to think there's a lot of calculation and thought went into this, so I don't want to demean the effort, but for a seven-dimensional construct, it was not taxing for him to do so.
Well, no, I mean, it's important that you bring that up, and here's why. I mean, when we look at Yahweh's name and we see the hand reaching down to the people, come, all they're doing is responding to him reaching down. I mean, that's what's happening here. And you know, I would change Baez. I mean, I know it's a law. I would actually say, from looking at the pictorial, that Yahweh's reaching down, and then in between there, that law, you know, that's not just a home, but it's a home of light, because without light, nothing we know exists. You know,
yeah, it's interesting that little image there of what is said to be a tentec. You know, all we know for certain is that the waw is the single most common letter in throughout the Hebrew text, and that its primary use is as a conjunction bringing things together. And so it is the awah, is the beginning of almost every sentence in Hebrew, and it speaks of combining things. So it and it means to increase and to add to. Beyond that, the tent peg was is really essential when you look at the perspective of Yahweh and this six-dimensional realm that we exist on here on Earth, and particularly the subset of that, which is the land of Israel. I'm reading right now where Dode says, to Dathan, which is really interesting. Once Dode is established in the city of Dode, and he has become the warrior king, he and God don't talk anymore. All of the psalms that Dode wrote, he wrote as a shepherd. Once he becomes king, he and God don't talk. There's a whole series of insights that are provided between Yahweh and Dode via the prophet Gad. And then it's Nathan that provides the communication link with Dode. If you look at what this particular passage I've just been translating, it's those that, listen, I got this beautiful home comprised of the most magnificent cedars, and the Yahweh's Ark of the Covenant is underneath a tent over there on the threshing floor. There's something wrong with this picture. And Yahweh tells Nathan, yeah, you're right. It is time that we build a more appropriate home for me to hang out in Israel. So I look at the tent peg as God being fairly low-key about the fact that as a seven-dimensional construct, an aspect of his nature is desirous of camping out with his creation here on Earth. And it's a very temporary hangout, and it's not all that impressive because God has a very low ego, very small ego. And so it is the smallest letter in the ancient Hebrew alphabet, and it's the implement, this is really key, it's the implement that enables a tent to stand. Without the tent peg, there is no tent. It's that one implement. In fact, it is really the only implement with a tent. There is a upright pillar that sits in the middle, but it's not considered an implement, and that is Yahweh in the form of Yosha standing up for us so we can stand with him. And then the one implement that is used is the tent peg. And so, I kind of look at it as God's way of saying that Abraham and Sarah, as the first family of the covenant, reaching up, looking up to him, being brought together, becoming greater, being enriched, being empowered, being joined together with each other and with Yahweh, representing the covenant family, and us hanging out together that way in a way that's, that's, God saying, I don't need a anything fancy. I got fancy here in the seventh dimension, but down there on Earth, let's not get carried away with fancy.
But no matter how you look at it,
the Vatican,
no matter how we look at it, it's people responding to him reaching out, which is what we're doing.
Right.
This is what lays religion low. We're responding to reality, and most people within the Babylonian matrix, of politics and religion and all the and capitalistic ventures and all this other, they're responding to the matrix.
Would
be the appropriate way to say. And we're trying to respond as best we can to Yahweh. I'm not saying I don't fall short responding, but I'm doing my best, my dead level best, to respond as appropriately as I can.
Absolutely.
And that's all any of us can do. Otherwise, we're into the religious matrix where we're our pure hearts somehow earn us somewhere, which I don't get that idea. I mean,
no.
That would make us all liars, of course, but I'm sorry.
This just goes on and says, but instead, the people expend their energy and grow weary amongst an abundance of worthlessness. And the nations which gather together in an excess of delusions and fantasies, which are poured out and poured forth, and they're unreal. They have no benefit whatsoever, resulting in nothingness, ultimately exhausting and destroying them. Well, religion is a good thing, and, you know, it's helped people, and no, it's worthless.
You look at all those empty buildings. Look at all those empty buildings out there tonight.
Every church out there with a pastor and a sermon, it is delusional. It's a fantasy. It's unreal. It has absolutely no benefit whatsoever. It is a waste of people's lives, their souls, their time. That's God's view of religion.
Labor. It's a waste of labor and money, even. It's
unreal, no benefit, resulting in nothingness, worthlessness, trifle, no value.
False hope keeps you away from the truth.
That is correct.
False hope is the worst thing in the world.
Right.
That's part of the
concept. Rather than looking and paying attention, Hena, which is standing up, looking up, paying attention to Yahweh, and developing an association with Him, they said they expend their energy and they grow weary with an abundance of worthlessness. The nations gather together with delusions and fantasies, which have no benefit. So then you have a woe, and a woe is not good. Oi! A strong warning to the one who causes and allows his companions and countrymen to drink, thereby associating them with your antagonizing venom. But also the intoxicating spirit for the purpose of looking at their genitals. And, of course, that was the big issue with Paul. Paul had this fixation on circumcision and saying, no, if you're circumcised, you can't be saved. And the first thing he does after arguing against the disciples in Jerusalem, against circumcision, saying that it was counterproductive, he circumcises his lover boy on the way out of town. You will get your fill of infamy, a little and lowly status, instead of honor and glory. You know, that's that whole line that Yosha was citing on the Sermon on the Mount, the Instruction on the Mount, where he was really clear about all this. And he says, you know, if you focus on the Torah, you're going to be considered important in heaven. But if you demean the Torah, you're going to be considered lowly and little in heaven. And, of course, Paul chose the name lowly and little.
Apollos literally means lowly and little. I mean, talk about 50 fingers pointing at Paul all over the place. It's just, it's become an insane asylum over here. Just what, you know, when you can show people these things and they still say, well, I want to support Paul.
When God speaks of intoxication, is he thinking of alcohol? Or is he using alcohol as a metaphor? For impairing judgment.
It's totally impairing judgment.
And it's alcohol as a spirit. So it's impaired judgment about the debilitating spirit. When he speaks of toxic venom, is he talking about an actual snake bite?
No.
He's talking about the poison
of religion.
It will kill you. It's toxin. It will kill you. And, you know, most toxins from snakes paralyze the victim. That's what religion does. It paralyzes the individual so they can no longer function. So these are specific metaphors that Yahweh was using to communicate. Choosing to intoxicate, in addition, you also elect to show them unacceptable, going round about their choice to become circumcised. Wow. And this is really interesting. It's Erel Mukab. You have two choices here. Both apply to Paul. One is choosing to deploy circular reasoning, and the other is choice to become circumcised. Now, if it were me, just, you know, in my trying to understand what John is saying here through his prophet, I would say there's a reason that this verb could mean deploy circular reasoning or choice to be circumcised, and that is because both apply. Paul deployed circular reasoning regarding the choice to be circumcised, and as a result, he intoxicated people and rendered them unacceptable. If you are a parent and you don't desire at least choose to the best of your ability, you know, sometimes we choose the covenant too late to be able to circumcise our sons on the eighth day. But if you're aware of this and you have a son, by all means, circumcise him on the eighth day. And if you're a man, by all means, if you weren't circumcised as a child, get circumcised. You are unacceptable without circumcision. You can't enter heaven. You can't participate in Pesach Matzah. You can't be part of the covenant. And, you know, the covenant is the only way into Yahweh's home. Pesach Matzah is the only means to salvation. And it's the only way into heaven. God is really clear on this. And yet Paul drew his line in the sand on circumcision, and for this prophecy to name him by name, fixate on the that his audience would be Gentiles, tell us the time that he would come into Jerusalem, which would be during the time of the Moed, and then say that his argument is going to be fixated, rendering people unacceptable because of circumcision, and the first time we hear about Paul, he's out preaching about not being circumcised and having the disciples send people out to say, wait a minute, you can't say that. And he's brought into Jerusalem to be confronted on circumcision, and then in his first letter, he takes the pen from the scribe at the end of it and says, now I'm writing this with my own hand, and he just lashes out against circumcision. I mean, that's as blunt as you can be in terms of identifying this individual. No wiggle room, folks.
No.
If you want to cling to Paul, know that God says that what he wrote was toxic. What he wrote leaves you unacceptable. What he said, no one will find satisfaction that accepts it. That he is, in fact, the plague of death. Now, if you want to accept Paul, knowing that God said this about him, then you are a moron. I'm glad that you are not going to be part of the covenant family, because I wouldn't want to spend eternity with somebody.
I do not want to spend eternity with you.
Yeah. And you're not going to have to.
Don't you think that's why Yahweh wants us to actually make connections and listen and hear?
Yes.
You know, you don't have to necessarily do the work God is doing. But you do have to make connections, and you have to thoughtfully consider these things in order to come to a place where you realize religion is just a total fraud.
And you have to invest time in the relationship.
You do. You have to.
Very simple. It's like any relationship. You don't invest time, there's no relationship.
Right.
It takes a series of actions to engage in this relationship. And the first of them is that you've got to realize that there's something tragically wrong with government and with religion. And you have to begin the process of disassociating yourself from these things because you recognize there's something dreadfully wrong with them. And then you have to be interested in whether or not there really is a God and whether or not he can be known. And you have to invest the time to get to know him. And then as you're doing that, and you're getting to knowing who he is in his own words, somewhere along the line, you better decide whether or not you like him, whether or not you respect him, whether or not you want to spend time with him. And as you listen to what he has to say, as you observe his testimony, then you've got to come to know the specific requirements that he has established for us to engage in a relationship with him. And then, as Larry says, the next step along the way, and this all takes time and a proper perspective and attitude, you've got to make the connections so that you go from knowing to understanding, because then you need to act, and you can't act based upon rote, knee-jerk, I know the five conditions of the covenant, so I'm going to accept them. No, you can't accept them. You can't trust and rely on Yahweh unless you understand who he is and what he's offering. So you've got to make those connections so that you understand. Do you have to be a genius? No. But you do need to spend the time. You've got to be willing to make the connections. And the reason that God has set it up that way is that we're going to spend eternity together. And the kind of people that he wants to spend eternity with and that we want to spend eternity with enjoy this process. It's not a burden.
Can I inject something?
Yeah, sure.
You know, I've just finished a book that covers probably every major scholar on Christianity from the last 2,000 years. And not one of them has drawn that conclusion. And it just occurred to me, because I was thinking about it today as I was rereading some parts, nowhere in all of these theological attempts to prove Christianity, none of them go back to the Torah. You cannot get this out of the New Testament. Because they don't talk about it in the New Testament.
No, because the religion is anti-Torah. Right.
It's anti-Torah.
So what was God doing when he told us about creation? What was he doing when he was telling us about the flood? What was he doing when he was telling us the story of the conditions of the Garden of Eden? What was he doing when he decided he would tell us about how he formed a covenant relationship with Abraham? What was all of that about? Why did he go and rescue the children of Israel from the crucible of human oppression? Why is that rescue of going from being a slave to being free played out over the course of the Mikra? Why does he then tell us about these invitations to meet and how essential they are to us? Why does he then have the Barim where the person he's chosen to represent him in the deliverance of this Torah summarizes its important aspects for us and tells us how to apply them to our lives and how to go about figuring things out, like, for example, determining whether or not someone is speaking for God or lying? And, you know, why would he go through all of that and then follow that with prophetic statements, all of which say the same thing? That when you reject my Torah, you're rejecting me. And that I'm going to stand on my Torah forever. My Torah is light. My Torah represents me.
Yeah, now, but see where people get lost here. And see, this is the whole thing, you know. It's the how do you create a religious deity? Well, you know, a mitzvah becomes a command, and then a Torah becomes a law, you know, and Shema becomes
a faith. Let's say that they were right. And
no,
that even though the Hebrew moods are all about volition, and you don't know that, but let's just say that you render these words in a religious fashion, and you change Torah to law, and mitzvah becomes a commandment, and mishpat is executing judgment. Let's just say you go there.
Wow. I'm sorry for you if you do, because
okay.
You're hopeless.
Let's say you go there.
Okay.
Who's the author?
All right.
Who's the author? Who's the author
The author of the Torah is Yahweh. The author of the...
So let's just say that Yahweh's choice is that, you know, I've given you limited free will. Let's just play this game.
Hypothetically, go ahead.
But I'm going to give you, hypothetically, I've given you limited free will, but I got some hard and fast rules here. I don't just have requirements for participating in the covenant. I've got some hard and fast rules here. And it's those rules that you need to, and I don't really have a word for obey, but it's those words you need to pay, those rules, those orders, those commandments that you need to pay attention to if we're going to get along. I got to go right back to it. Who's the author?
Still young.
Okay, so if what he said is invalid, how can God be valid? Why would you choose to believe anything this God said if what he said there was invalid? Or, since that's what he said, why don't you pay attention to it? How could you think that a man was authorized to annul what God said. Just pretending, for example, that it's all a bunch of commands. It's all a bunch of laws. Even if it were, considering that, that the author is God himself, now what, folks? How do you get
Now we're all dead, but I hear what you're saying. You can't do it either way.
Right.
I'm saying the way that they get away with it. In other words, for those of us who understand, okay, you know, because I'm with you, and I'm in the same way. I view it the same way Doe does. Understand that there's a creator that we're trying to respond to, and all he's really interested in is our response.
Right. Yeah, Doe, you know, wrote the 119th Psalm, which is takes each of the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, goes through an alphabetical order, and provides 22 stanzas, each of 8, which is the number of eternity, statements on how to properly observe the Torah so as to be able to end up
respond
in the position that Dode ended up in. Dode says, hey, I'm coming to heaven, and you're going to let me in. Why? Because I'm carrying the Torah. I'm taking the Torah with me, and so I'm going to show up in heaven, and you can't keep me out. That's why he wrote it.
I love that
being in that same position.
Yeah.
And so even if you were to misconstrue Torah as law and mitzvah as command, and even if you were to say it was written to Yisrael, you don't get a mulligan if you're God. You know, God can't play the outcome-based instruction game. You know, he can't do the Allah thing where he has in 2106, you know, whenever we contradict ourselves, you just simply throw the previous verse into oblivion. And it's the last statement that we made is the one that counts, even if it contradicts something we previously said. A real God can't do that. They're not credible. And so you don't have a God that's credible if you are annulling, if you're disregarding the Torah, no matter what the Torah might be. Now, the fact is that a God who would have a bunch of commands isn't appealing. But as we know, Torah doesn't mean law, and mitzvah does not mean command. But as I say, even if it does, Christianity's screwed.
Well, yeah, either way, they lose. I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying how they employ it, the way it has to be employed. I mean, when you start, could you actually keep the laws? I mean, assuming, I mean, there's the Beit no longer exists, you know. It couldn't be done. I mean, how do you
have a family?
Storehouse,
the whole thing. Beit is a family relationship. How do you have a family relationship with a bunch of laws? You know, I can guarantee you that with my family, we had no laws. You know, my wife and I raised two boys. We had no laws. We had some household rules, some requirements of participating in our family, some things that were expected as participants, and those were provided as instructions, as guidance, as directions. And if our children, which they did on frequent occasions, disregarded them, there were consequences, but they weren't kicked out of the family. You know, God's guidance on how to participate in his family is no different than what we provided as parents, except he's a lot better at it than we were. But his willingness to perfect imperfect children is the whole purpose of the Torah. You know, he didn't kick Dode out because Dode did dastardly things. No more than he kicked us out. You know, our dastardly behavior may shortchange the quality of our relationship while we're here on Earth, and it may influence somebody else. Now, in the case of Dode, I actually think the fact that Dode became a bad boy and became self-absorbed during the later part of his life is actually a benefit for us, even though it forestalled the continued communication between he and and Yahweh. And I say that for two reasons. One is that we have an enormous amount of material from Dodd. I mean, the Psalms are, it's just this, you could spend a lifetime just translating and thinking about the Psalms of Dodd. And so we already, and all they talk about is really the relationship that Dodd had with Yahweh and how to properly observe the Torah and get the most out of it. So we, getting more from Dodd than, for example, what you have in the 119 Psalm, where are you going to go with it? I mean, we have plenty.
It's kind of the masterpiece there.
Right, it's a masterpiece. We have plenty. We have more than is necessary. And so getting more would not be particularly helpful. Might be overload for us. But the advantage of Dodd being a bad boy, and of Yahweh still saying that I would establish my kingdom on earth in the model of the kingdom of Dodd, and that my house is going to be right up the ridge from Dodd's house, and that Dodd is righteous, upright, and vindicated by being a really bad boy, and there could not be a better example of how
that's perfect.
Perfect. The imperfect.
Yeah, right. And then that's perfect for us because it tells us these, you know, this concept of running around with the pure heart and being religious and loving everyone and, you know, never falling off the wagon and, you know, all this nonsense. You know, the whole pure religious shtick is a lie because it's the last thing that Dodd was. And so, it works for us perfectly. For us, like real people.
You could not have a better scenario. And then to see, as you know, as I'm spending all this time now in Chronicles, whoever thought I'd spend all this time in Chronicles, but anyway, I'm spending this time in Chronicles, and what I'm finding is that it had exactly the influence on Dodd that you would expect. Yahweh said, you know, you're not going to build my house. Yahweh said, you know, Dodd for communication with Yahweh had to go to Gad and Nathan. It truncated their direct dialogue. And it just rendered Dodd the second part of his life as a living example of what the purpose of the Torah is. That God's not looking for perfect people. There aren't any. He wants passionate people that take the time to know who he is and engage in the relationship. And Dodd left us with a treasure. It's not like Dodd's life was wasted. There's nobody that left us with more valuable material than he did. And also, the fact is that he didn't build a second mountain of material. That really is, I think he delivered every bit as much as Yahweh intended, and it was a job well done. And then, so that we don't put Dodd up on a pedestal, you know, Dodd falls off the wagon.
Yeah.
Upon you is the binding cup of Yahweh's right hand. And really, this yamin is really a. It means from the sea. It means that it means going south. It speaks of being against.
Ben Yamin.
Yeah, Ben Yamin. So what Yahweh was saying here is, man, you're going south to the Gentiles. You know, you are going away from me. Now, the right hand, you know, if you want Yamin to be right hand, the right hand means judgment. I'm judging you. My power is against you. But it also is symbolic of Yam is the Hebrew word for sea. And so it's therefore you're being cast into the sea of Gentiles. Therefore, public humiliation and a lowly status will be your reward. You will be lowly and little. Again, he's trying to tell us, pay attention. I've said Shaul is the plague of death, and now I'm telling you that Paulos is reprehensible. Lowly.
Now, wait a minute. Just let me throw one more thing, because I did a note while we were doing the show here. And the another thing he said, not to... passed by Ben Yamin, but also he mentioned earlier, not just lowly a little, but also you should question him and say, oh, he's
right.
questioning.
Right.
So
oh, yeah.
That's it. So you got question him, you got lowly a little, and you got Shaol. Now you got Benjamin.
Oh, and you've got the argument based on circumcision and the audience is Gentile.
Well, that too, obviously.
Okay,
but I'm just saying it's all tied to the name.
Who was named Paul, Shaul, approached Gentiles, condemned circumcision. The author
another candidate
of the Christian New Testament. Indeed, from the grievous injustice and blatant wrongdoing in opposition to that which purifies, empowers, and enriches, he will constantly keep you covered and continually protected. As for the destructive and demonic beasts, he will scatter them as a result of the blood of humankind, and also this grievous injustice against the blatant wrongdoing in opposition to the land and all of her inhabitants. So what Chabaouk is saying on behalf of Yahweh here is Chabaouk, one of the reasons I love Yahweh is that, okay, so we're really inferior to him now, to Yahweh, obviously. But Yahweh wants us to throw in our two cents. In the Torah, the last book of the Torah is the words of Moshe. You know, so God likes it for us to throw in our two cents. This is Chabaouk saying, you know, this guy is the plague of death. But Yahweh, if you look to him, he'll protect you from all of that. He will keep you from harm, protecting you against this whole poison, this whole toxin, if you just embrace what he offers that empowers and enriches. What empowers and enriches? That happens to be the fourth and fifth benefit of the covenant. And he will constantly keep you covered and continually protected as far as the destructive and demonic nature of this Pauline religion. Now, it does take some courage to expose and condemn Paul. And Chabaouk is saying, yeah, but if you're willing to do it, God's going to protect you. So what do you have to risk? What do you have to lose besides your soul? If you stand up, God's going to enrich you, he's going to empower you, and he's going to protect you from that toxin. He's going to protect you against the grievous injustice. So I see this as Chabaouk. You know, it's like the Chabaouk in the middle of all this, you know, because he's reading Pauline doctrine, and Pauline doctrine is God died for your sins. And Chabaouk said, wait a minute. God, you can't die. You know, so it's just the lovely way that Yahweh likes working with us. Now, you know, Chabaouk is clearly getting this directly from Yahweh as opposed to us. And we're getting it directly from Yahweh. I mean, I'm not sure there's really any difference in the way Chabaouk got it and the way we're getting it. But I think Yahweh likes it when we throw in our two cents. And that's what
he's asked us to do that. I mean, that's what he's saying. Stand up and be opposed to. He says right in there. I mean, this is what we're doing.
Now, I'm going to tell you that my single favorite aspect of Chabaouk is in the next statement. And it's a subtle thing. But, you know, I'm constantly, you know, when I was doing the Islam thing, and I said, listen, Muhammad was it with Islam. He's Allah's lone messenger, and the Muslims said, oh, no, Jesus was a messenger of Allah, and David was a messenger of Allah, and Abraham was a messenger of Allah. They never talk about Alexander the Great, even though there's a whole surah devoted to him. And you say, no. Those were caricatures. A caricature is when you create something that is designed to fool people because there's some resemblance of some sort. But the caricature is not the actual character that is a historic personage. And the reason I like this next statement is that it speaks of succeeding with a caricature. And that is what Paul did. the Paul Jesus Christ that he's constantly speaking about bears no resemblance whatsoever to the actual Yosha. None.
No, he doesn't. No, he's not bumping into people, forgiving them and loving them. If the scribes could have written, bumped into a lamppost and said, "Oh, I forgive you, Mr. Lamppost," they would have done it. I mean, it's so ludicrous.
He based his whole goddamn religion based on a caricature. And so if you're not smart enough to see that it's a caricature, Chabaouk is laying it out here for you. That's why I like this next statement. How does he succeed with a caricature? I'm going to answer that question. Because people are too goddamn, not using this because it is the right term to use. People are so goddamn stupid, so ignorant, they don't bother to compare Montaigne 5, 6, and 7 to Paul's caricature of Jesus Christ to recognize they have nothing in common. They're completely different individuals. So when he says, how do they succeed with a caricature? Because the vast preponderance of people are stupid. They're ignorant.
They put it all in the same book, too. And then they tell them, no part of the book contradicts the other part of the book. But it's full of contradictions.
Let me tell you something.
Here it says that Paul's version of God is a caricature.
Yep. And he's right.
It's pretend.
I did a post on that today. Just exactly that. I really did.
Yeah.
They're valuing
an idolatrous image that he has shaped, that he has formed. And then it goes on and says, indeed, he will construct him, fashioning him by offering a veiled form of a pagan god. Well, what was the veiled form of a pagan god? Dionysus. Well,
Dionysus, and also the Druid Savior, Hesus.
Jesus. Hesus. Depends on how you pronounce the G, but it was it's either Hesus or Jesus, depending on...
Well, everybody I ever heard that took Greek,
but it's G-E-S-U-S, Hesus or Jesus, depending on... And I don't know how the Druids pronounce their G. But the fact is that this is precisely what he did. And he even had his god, quote, Dionysus. And so does he succeed with a caricature? Indeed, he will construct him, fashioning him, by offering a veiled form of a pagan god. If I were to summarize Paul's letters, that's the term that I would use. And I would tell people, how in the world did you buy this? How in the world could you be fooled by this? You've been played for an idiot. And I was played for an idiot, so I understand how it's possible. But that is a summation of Pauline doctrine. It is as precise in terms of how he managed to succeed. He created a caricature of God. And then he goes on to say, by offering a veiled form of a pagan god and by teaching lies, that which is deceptive and misleading, mistaken and useless, instruction, guidance, and direction, that is completely disingenuous. So that he adds credence and partiality to the one who created the construct of him. Now, what does that mean? I mean, the reason that Paul didn't come out and tell us the truth, and the truth is that Paul is his own God. That Paul is the Messiah, just like Muhammad. Muhammad, when he speaks of we throughout the Quran, Paul Muhammad and Allah are one and the same. Allah is simply a Muhammad's alter ego. Jesus Christ is nothing but a projection of Paul's persona. Paul is the savior of Pauline Christianity. But the reason he didn't come out and just say it that way is he was trying to usurp Yosha's credibility. And so the reason that he created this caricature based on a pagan god is because it gave credence and partiality to Paul himself. That's why, what he said was so stupid, so irrational, so obviously errant, that the only reason that people even consider what he had to say is he claimed to speak for his caricature of God. That's why he did it. So this speaks to the entirety of Pauline doctrine, the entirety of Paul's letters, Paul's purpose, Paul's means, and how Paul goes about fooling people, why he did it this way. For him to make the shepherds bound and moot. Now, shepherds are really important to Yahweh. Remember how many times Yahusha, on that final meeting he has with the disciples, and it's the final time, again, they don't recognize him. They're all having breakfast out there on in the Sea of Galilee. And Yahusha goes to Shimon, and over he says, "Shepherd my sheep. Shepherd my sheep." You know, what was the one thing that Yahweh told Dod that he wanted him to do, that he expected of him? Shepherd my sheep.
Shepherd.
Shepherd my sheep. You know, I want you to nurture them, to guide them, to protect them, to care for them, to live with them, to be in, you know, to be someone that protects them. And so what this does is it rendered the shepherds bound and moot. And you look at Paul's, Shimon Kephish, Peter's response to Paul. And while he is pretty, aggressive in Second Peter, and he's right in Paul's face in the first couple of statements that he makes at the Jerusalem summit. For the most part, he doesn't say a hell of a lot about him. Shimon Kephish was muted. And you even look at Yahu Kanan. You know, Yahu Kanan doesn't say a whole lot about him. And yeah, it's obvious that he's speaking about Paul in the opening of the that open letter to the Ephesians, where it says, you know, that it's good that you
false
were not
apostles.
By the false apostle. But for the most part, he says very little about him. They were muted by him. They were tied up by him. You know, he was really a spellbinder because of this caricature of Jesus Christ that he had used to bolster his credibility.
Yeah, well, we're not the most popular group, and they weren't either.
No.
What he was saying was, you know, he was being a Gnostic. He was incorporating all the popular religious belief systems and everything else into his nonsense. And you know, people that were saying, look, the Torah is being fulfilled here. Take a real serious look at it. This proves the Torah. You know, people were saying, what? You know, I mean, haven't you heard about the wonders of, you know, whatever, you know?
Let's go over this next statement, and then I want Kirk to share with what he's learned by what it is that Christians cling to when it's so obvious that Paul is a false prophet. Woe to the one who says to the wooden pillar, return from the dead, rising up to blind by providing false testimony and precluding further observation. To the rock, he who consistently teaches, be silent. Behold, he has actually been seized, captured, controlled, and covered, brilliantly shimmering, extremely valuable and desirable without any spirit in his midst. Well, what does Paul constantly say? It's about the cross. The cross is the source of life. It's all about that wooden pillar, the cross. And Chabot's saying, no. Woe to the one who speaks of the wooden pillar. Woe to the one that speaks of resurrection from the dead. God didn't die. He was not resurrected from the dead. And that pagan cross will do you absolutely no good whatsoever. And what it does is it blinds people and it precludes them from further observation. That's pretty in your face.
Yeah.
As for The Rock, yeah, that's you've got two choices on The Rock. Shimon Kepesh, who spoke against Shaul, Paul, or you've got Yosha. And his every statement is antagonistic to Shaul, Paul. Take your pick.
Wow.
So what did you find out when you were, the smartest scholars
these
of Christianity
are, these are
justify Paul's letters when Paul is knowingly and deliberately contradicting everything Yosha said and, of course, everything that Jehovah said?
Well, here's the problem, and the way I looked at it is I had friends who, one in particular, who got it, went up to his preacher, and the preacher said, that's wrong. To get it, and he lost his way.
Yeah.
And we also have some friends that I talked to that are members of the covenant, and they have relatives and who still go to church, and they taught them everything they could teach them, and they go back and their preachers tell them this is not true, you can't be true, etc., etc., etc. And I was trying to figure out, well, what is it they're basing it on, unless you're talking with them? So I picked up that old book once again I had in my shelves on the New Testament documents, are they reliable? And basically, it contradicts everything that's in question in Paul, because they don't really address the things that are in question in Paul, which makes question in Paul such a brilliant book. And I'm not trying to flatter you; it just happens to be, you know, right there in your face. And also, now that we're reading Shavuot, to make just a couple of short statements. They have a chapter in this particular book, and it's the importance of Paul's evidence. Of course, we know that Paul doesn't have any evidence, but that's
no,
the chapter.
No, there's only one evidence. There's only one bit of evidence that counts with Yahweh. Prophecy. Accurate prophecy is the only evidence. I mean, you can speak for Yahweh by quoting something that Yahweh has said through a prophet, or you can claim that you have direct insights from Yahweh, that he's speaking directly to you and asking you to share what he has to say. But if you're making that claim, there's only one evidence that counts. I mean, I've read the Tabatim. The Tabatim says prophecy. Now, there are some other criterion in evidence that counts. You've got to get history right and prophecy right. You've got to be consistent with what Yahweh says. You can't speak in the names of other gods. You can't have an ego. I mean, there's some other things that go along with it. But that's the only evidence that counts. So these people, they didn't look to Yahweh's insight.
And it's not a name in this book or a footnote in this book that you wouldn't know who these people are or couldn't Google them and find it. My gosh, that's every important book of theology in Christendom. So, but to make a long story shorter, it started out, and I'm going to paraphrase, but I'm just going to cut through a few little places. You know, it starts out with the statement of the conversion of Paul has long been regarded as the weightiest evidence for truth in Christianity. Well, I don't know how that could be, but that's
so
where
here
it starts.
He is, unlike every encounter with Yosha, where the lame were made to walk, the blind were enabled to see, he is stricken so that he can't walk, and he's made blind so that he cannot see, and that rather than some citation from the Torah to explain what he's doing, he gets a citation from Dionysus, that's
well, I wrote a note. You must be kidding over here with a question mark.
Yeah.
But then it goes through, and they're looking for internal evidences. And quite frankly, I'm just going to paraphrase this. If you look for the internal evidences, like this is mentioned here, and this is here, and that proves that most everything that Paul writes, as I was going through it, is contradictory because he can't get his story straight any time. Is that correct?
He never does.
So, I mean, if you look at internal evidence to prove, as they try to, there ain't any. I mean, or there's
if
so much against it.
You know, one of the problems with lying is you can't remember what you said. And,
right.
You know, Paul did not have, for example, with Luke wrote the book of Acts and has three different accounts. Paul didn't have that testimony with him when he provided that his account three different times, and each of the three times he contradicts himself. That is proof that he was lying.
Yeah, and it's hardly inspired.
Oh, yeah. That's the reason Paul travels so much. It's hard to get caught in a lie when you don't stay around long enough for them to remember anything.
That every letter that the man wrote was, you know, why did you give up? Why did you turn on me? Why did you give up on and go the opposite direction? Why did you reject me immediately after I left town? Because it was obvious the man was lying.
Well, here's a couple more sentences you'll have fun with. So he goes on to say, even where he doesn't quote the actual sayings of Jesus, and even where I don't think he quotes it ever, he misquotes one.
No, he only quotes Yosha once, and at that one time, he does the same thing that he does with everything he quotes from Yahweh. He takes it out of context, he truncates it so that he brings things together that are separated by other words, and he takes a misquote that he has truncated out of context to apply the opposite of what Yosha was actually saying. And he only does that once, and he got it wrong.
Well, this is what you'd be confronted with, or what the preacher is going to be. He's confronted with, so he can tell you you're crazy for believing that the Torah is not thrown away. Yeah, no. So he goes on to say, and he shows throughout
the
work.
By the way, did Yosha say the Torah was annulled?
Never.
No, he said the exact opposite.
Did Yahweh ever say the Torah was annulled?
He said it would never be annulled.
No. Did any one of the disciples ever say the Torah was annulled?
No, sir.
No, so you have one person claiming the Torah was annulled against everybody else. The Torah says it wasn't annulled. All the prophets say it wasn't annulled. Everybody that Yahweh proved that he spoke through said that it was going to be eternal. Yosha said it was going to be eternal. The disciples Yosha picked said it was going to be eternal. And so everybody's on the same page. The Torah is eternal, and not a single stroke of a single letter is ever going to be annulled on it. And you got this one person said over here that it's going to be annulled. And you've got 2.4 billion people.
Then it must be annulled.
Well, can I add one thing there that's kind of important?
Yeah.
Since none of them debate that Shimon was a disciple, the reason he cautions people not to read Paulos' letters is because they read to Torahlessness.
Right.
You know, I mean,
right.
He says it just like that. And so,
yeah.
You know, if he's saying that, you know, by reading Paulos' letters, you know, this is going to lead to destruction, damnation, and Torahlessness, because that's what he says.
Right.
This is a problem.
Yeah, when Yosha is speaking of the wolf in sheep's clothing, and of the one that would be called lowly and little by trying to annul the Torah, he specifically says that get away from me, those of you who are Torahless.
That's right.
They all say exactly the same thing, and you got this one guy out here who's contradicting himself and God, and you got 2.4 billion people that are believing the guy that's contradicted everything that God has said.
But that's also what Yahusha said. What Yahweh said is that, you know, the Lord has many children, I only have a few, and you know, Yahusha is confirming that, saying the path is narrow. So you know, obviously this narrow path is the one you want to find. I mean, it's not the one with billions of people on it. I mean, wow.
Yeah, and by the way, that narrow path that he says that few find, he made clear that path is through the Torah. This is the Torah.
Yeah, he says, start with the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, enter at the narrow doorway, which is Pesach.
Right.
And I always thought, you got to understand, when I actually began learning Yahweh's words, I mean, actually, because they were impossible from, at least from my perspective, looking at the junk that's in English-based, what they call Old Testaments, the covenant writings they call Old Testaments. I wouldn't even call it old. I would call it Satan's version of covenant writings or something like that.
Yeah.
But when I'm sitting there trying to read it, I never understood, of course, that Pesach was the narrow doorway. So when I learned this stuff, like you said last week, hey, isn't that the first time you ever heard it? Well, yeah, of course the first time I ever heard that that's the narrow doorway, which makes perfect sense. I always wondered, where is this doorway? Now, it's obvious
it
was in front of my face. Yeah, I mean, that's why they painted the doors red. You know?
And, I get it. It's the doorway to life.
What
is Pesach? It's the doorway to life.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Not a doorway, it's the doorway to life. He says that this narrow doorway leads to life in few that are that find it, and the broad way leads to death and destruction. And many there are that find it. He specifically said it's the doorway of life. Well, there's only one doorway, and that one doorway, Pesach, is the doorway to life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, when you asked me that last week, it was like, well, no, I've from the time I've understood that Pesach's the way to walk, I mean, I understood that was the doorway, and that's the way I learned it.
So, what else did they say, Kirk?
Well, let me give you just it gets better. Speaking of Paul, he says, shows throughout his works how well acquainted he is with them, and he's talking about the Gospels. Now, the Gospels weren't even written when Paul was writing his letter.
Yeah, that's correct. So he could not have been acquainted with them because they had not been written.
Yeah, so how did he get so acquainted with it? Yeah, so
I'm pretty sure if they had been written, he probably would have quoted them just to get some authority.
Absolutely.
To gain some authority. Yeah, but Paul actually said of those that were the source of the material that is in the four historical eyewitness accounts, that he said they are presumed leaders, that they have presumed credibility, but they mean nothing to me. He actually said that the disciples meant nothing to him. So he, by doing that, he is completely doing the opposite of what the Christians are saying here. Rather than being familiar with them, they hadn't been written yet, but Paul has gone out and said, hey, they're just presumed. What they say means nothing to me.
Yeah.
They say no better than what I say.
Mm-hmm.
Right. In fact, what Paul says, if there's a gospel other than the gospel that I'm sharing you with, no matter how similar it might be, reject
the angels
give
it to you.
Yeah.
And of course, they didn't teach the gospel. That's another thing. They're probably not writing about.
Of course. But let's just say that you rendered it from the Hebrew, and it's the Tob Malach, and the Hebrew would be the Tob Malach, the message which is beneficial
and
it's no problem having Yahweh Khanan speak be translated speaking of a euangelion, because it would be a translation of Tob Malach. And so you can go right back to the Hebrew and know what he said. But Paul in Galatians speaks of the fact that there is another message that is considered a euangelion that is slightly different than his, and the fact that it's different, you have to reject it and accept his. So he is rejecting
what the disciples are rejecting.
Right. I mean, everything that they're saying here is the opposite of what's true.
And then he goes on to say,
"Yeah,
well, you see, the difference now is when I read this as a Christian, feeling pretty comfortable that maybe the preacher wasn't so stupid, that he was. Okay, everybody's agreeing with this. Is that now that I have a proper perspective, I can go through this thing and I can just scribble all it in the columns going, that's absurd because of this, that's absurd because of that.
Right.
You know, not that I'm trying to get in a debate with everybody in the world on this, because if you're not interested, you ain't interested. But the point being, there are people who encounter this all the time, and I thought we might just expose how stupid these great scholars are.
Right,
and
they are,
this,
really.
This one's a killer here. He shows... let's see, in particular, it says where we ought to compare the ethical section of the epistles to the Romans, that's 12:1 through 15:7, where Paul summarizes the practical implications of the gospel for the lives of the believers. He compares it with the Sermon on the Mount to see how thoroughly imbued the apostle was with the teaching of the master.
Wow.
I mean,
so Romans 12 is comparable
to Montaigne 5, 6, and 7.
Yes, sir. That's what he said.
Wow.
Besides, they're in Elsewhere.
Just think of that for a moment. Yosha's statement, his first and longest public address, chronicled by an eyewitness, Netanyahu, 5, 6, and 7 of Maya. It specifically condemns Paul by reputation, by name. Specifically speaks of the ongoing and enduring nature of the Torah, and said, "Do not think for a moment that I've come to annul the Torah." And Paul's entire gospel is based upon the Torah being annulled. And you as a Christian scholar are going to compare that discussion from Yosha, which specifically condemns Christianity and Paul's writings, and say that Paul's writings in Romans are to be compared to that?
They might be as big a psychopath as Paul was, if you think about it.
Oh, God.
I really think that's
how stupid you'd have to be. I mean, it's just stupid. Ignorant.
Well, this is one of the great fellows of the 20th century.
Letters are after your name. It is unbelievably ironic. It's just stupid.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I guess there's a little bit more meat on the bone here. It says, besides, there and elsewhere, Paul's chief arguments in his ethical instruction is the example of Christ himself. Well, that's the first thing he said is true.
But he never provides that example, ever.
I know.
Ever. And by the way, his example was, he was Torah observant.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
He celebrated Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkotim. He was circumcised. He was Torah observant. That is his example. He quoted as the answer to everything.
Yeah, he never got off the path, and he never changed the direction. He never talked about anything
right.
But the first path.
Right. And so, Paul does the opposite of that. That's why this thing said he created a caricature. I want to read real quickly Paul's statement in Galatians, since we've just heard what Yahweh said through the prophet Chabaok.
Okay.
So, Christo has truly set us free. He set us free. Not the Torah set us free. Christo set us free. Now, make sure that you stay free and don't get tied up again in slavery to the Torah. So, his Christo set us free of the Torah as opposed to observing the Torah. Listen,
yes.
I, Paul, tell you this. If you are counting on circumcision to make you right with God, then Christ will be of no benefit to you. So, rather than circumcision being the sign of the covenant and a requirement for being part of God's family, he's saying, no, if you're circumcised, then my Christo, my caricature, is of no benefit to you. I'll tell you again, if you are trying to find favor with God by being circumcised, you must obey every regulation in the whole Torah of Moses. Where does it say that?
Nowhere.
For if you are trying to make yourself right with God by keeping
every
the law, the Torah, then you have been cut off from Christ. I mean, how does anybody in their right mind read this and say this man was speaking for Yosha when Yosha said, man, nothing in the Torah is being annulled. And the Torah, doesn't it say that you must be circumcised to be part of the covenant? To be saved by God to enter heaven?
Yeah.
No one in their right mind.
Right.
These people are not in their right mind.
Their right mind. You believe this. You have fallen away from God's grace. Well, you may have fallen away from your Lord's grace. That is for damn sure. But who live by the Spirit eagerly await to receive by faith the righteousness God has promised to us. Yeah, we're just by faith. We're just going to eagerly wait by faith after we've rejected the Torah.
Good luck.
What did Yosha say in the Sermon on the Mount about those who reject the Torah? Get away from me, you who are Torahless. I don't know you.
Well, they don't believe
so
Yahusha, but they some of them do believe Shimon, so we might want to put Shimon out.
For we place our faith in Jesus Christ, of which he's told us nothing about, and he's created a caricature of him, there is no benefit in being circumcised or being uncircumcised. So now, the covenant means nothing.
Right.
What is important, Pesach means nothing because you can't participate in Pesach if you're not circumcised.
So you can't go into the narrow door.
So why in the hell did Yosha fulfill Pesach if Pesach means nothing?
Yeah,
if
right.
You can't benefit from Pesach because you're not circumcised, and Yahweh precludes it specifically, participating in Pesach if you're not circumcised.
Well, this would be a good question, wouldn't it, Craig?
Then, yeah.
That'd be a good question.
How in the hell can Jesus Christ be a benefit to you if you're not circumcised?
Well, that would be a problem. I mean, if
what is
from my perspective,
is expressing
it would be
faith and love. Mm-hmm. You were running away so well. Who has held you back from following the truth?
Faith's a whore, though.
It certainly isn't God. He is the one that's calling you to freedom. This is false teaching, like a little yeast spreads through the whole batch of dough. Now let's. Let's create a myth about matzah. You know, if you're going to talk about yeast, you piece of crap, then understand that yeast is what is removed on matzah, and you've just condemned matzah.
Yeah, you can't do matzah without
being
pizza.
So you are all yeasted right to the gills.
That's
this
right.
False teaching is like a little yeast that spreads through the whole batch. I am trusting the Lord, yes, he sure as hell is, who is Satan, to keep you from believing false teaching. God will judge that person, whoever he is, who has been confusing you. Yeah, confusing you with the Torah. That would be Yosha. That would be Yahweh. Dear brothers and sisters, if I were still preaching that you must be circumcised, as some say I do, why am I still being persecuted? If I am no longer preaching salvation through the cross, that upright pillar of Christ, no one would be offended.
That
I wish
would.
Those troublemakers who want to mutilate you by circumcision would mutilate themselves.
He said castrate themselves. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just reading this from the New Living Translation, but he didn't say.
Yeah, well, you know,
correct.
You know, business hasn't been that good over here lately. So I was thinking about trying out for a position with them as a kind of a head scribe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I figured I could. Uh-huh. You know, I don't know that I could completely rewrite a Bible, but.
This whole thing that Yahweh has, way too complicated. Five requirements of the to participate in the covenant. You've got to follow this path that leads to God. There are seven steps along the way. You know, that's way too many. And you've got to read the Torah, and you've got to think about it to be able to trust and rely on Yahweh. Way too much to ask of people. So you want to apply for the job of chief scribe, and it's going to be, but I, Larry and Ager, say...
Can I just give you guys an example? I mean, just an example.
This is going to be the Gospel of the Larianator?
Well, this would be, you know, my job as a religious scribe is what it would be. We can go over here to Bereshith 12:1, you know, one of my favorite passages where it says, "And Yahweh said to Abram, of your own volition, you will literally walk away and genuinely come away from your country, away from your relatives, away from your father's house," which is a result of the relationship, you know, I'll show you and provide. And what my translation would read is, "And throwing lightning bolts at the feet of Abram, Yahweh said, I command you, scumbag, into an eternal relationship with me. Pick up your goddamn bags and go in a hurry. Be quick about it."
By the way, I really was just kidding. You can bring all of that babble stuff with you.
I figure, you know, we could just take that out of there. I mean, I just didn't even mention Babylon, so why would I bother? So this way I could probably get a job as at least chief scribe. I might not be able to write my own Bibles, but I could probably be head scribe.
There you go. We had a comment in the discussion in the chat room about Shavuah, and just asked for some brief insights on Shavuah, like what is the wave offering and that sort of thing. You know, Shavuah is a really, really simple concept. Shavuah is a party where you invite everyone who lists. Doesn't matter if they're young or old, doesn't matter if they know Yahweh or if they don't know Yahweh,
pagans,
doesn't matter if they're men or women, doesn't matter if they're pagan, doesn't matter anything. Invite anybody to the feast. You know, Pesach, you could only be invited if you're part of the covenant. You know, but not Shavuah. Shavuah is invite
Shavuah
everybody.
Is inclusive.
Right. And the beneficiaries of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, which are Yahweh's immortal, perfected, adopted family, are enriched and empowered on Shavuah to be able to effectively communicate with these individuals. It's the time that they get to witness the enrichment and empowerment that is part of our lives so that we can tangibly demonstrate why it's a really good idea to engage in the covenant, to participate with Yahweh. And what is the wave offering is that we are uplifting the ingredients that are part of God's symbolism of, for example, purified grain, which represents the children of the covenant, and of the chaff that blows away, and of the olive oil that represents the spirit of Yahweh, and the cleansing, and the anointing, and the light of Yahweh, and you know we're offering these souls up to Yahweh in the presence of those who do not know Him, in such a way that it would encourage those who are open to knowing God, those who are willing to walk away from religion, to do so. And we follow this up now that we're prepared with Teruah, where rather than inviting everybody to the party, we just simply blurt it out, say, you know, walk away from religion. Walk to God along the path He has provided. I see Teruah as being that simple. Shavuah also marks the time that the Torah was revealed. You know, its fulfillment in throughout history, its primary fulfillment with the revelation of the Torah. Its secondary fulfillment is when Yoshe and 4,000 Yah spoke of the set apart spirit empowering and enriching God's family, and then we see its manifestation in the lives of those who recognized that Yoshe was Torah observant, that he walked right out of the pages of the Torah, and they received the ability and the empowerment to share the Torah, prophets, and Psalms in whatever language people might speak. In other words, they're doing the same thing we're doing right now. The Torah, prophets, and Psalms all revealed in Hebrew, and yet we are in English communicating what God said in Hebrew. That's what Shavuah is all about. You know, it's the promise of the Shabbat, the promise of seven.
Yep. Well, and
yeah,
that encapsulates
the Shavuah and Teruah are the tombs of the Mikra that actually involve other outside the family. You know, Passover, Matzah, and Bikurim are family events. You have Shavuah,
right.
You invite everybody. Teruah
right.
is still a family event, but it involves warning others. But the fact that those
right.
two are right by each other is kind of interesting to me because for the timeline of fulfillment.
Right.
Love
yeah,
it.
That area between the two is kind of where the mixture comes, where we do get involved with, you know, trying to help others come to know Yahweh.
Good
yeah,
point.
Just warn the rest.
Yeah, but I also think the point that was made, I don't know whose voice that was, but it is Shavuah also points to the importance of the Yovel and understanding
the Yovel.
How the Yovel integrates
yeah.
in all of this. And the Yovel, the year of Yah's Lamb, is the time when debts are forgiven because we're freed by the Torah of our debts. When slaves are freed because we are liberated by the Torah. We're not enslaved by it. It's exactly the opposite of what Paul wrote. And where the land returns to Yahweh, because Yahweh is returning to the land, and we get to return to the land with Yahweh, because the entire earth will be transformed into this Garden of Eden. It's a
Even before I began to know Yahweh, I understood that the return had to happen on a Yobel year, because I understood that's when all debts were. I got that much.
It's all based on the promise of the seven and the fact that Yahweh is very specifically telling us that by fulfilling the first four Moed Mikre in year 4000 Yah, in the fourth millennium of human existence, that he is honoring the fourth and fifth promises that encapsulate the fourth and fifth benefit of participating in the covenant. We're enriched and we're empowered. So that's what the day
is. I got a question for you. You guys talk a lot about the dimensions, and I actually prefer to instead of saying universe, I really prefer saying creator of the dimension anymore. But that being the case, Yahweh's in number seven. We become beings of light. Okay. Energy-based life forms, spiritual.
Right. Uh-huh.
And so now we can do all these incredible things throughout the universe. It's important how he remakes the universe in front of us on day eight, you know, on Sukkah. Now, here's the thing. Do we then walk through another matrix to get to the next dimension? Because I'm thinking we do. I'm just guessing.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that. I'm guessing.
Yeah, how do we get from 3.5
three
to
and
four?
A half to 7?
3.5 to 4 is pretty straightforward. We become light. But how do we get from 4 to 5, 5 to 6, and 6 to 7? The biggest issue really is that the existing universe, we just can't perceive it. It's just like, you know, if let's just say that you didn't have sight, and all of a sudden you were given sight, that would be really equivalent of the transition from the fourth dimension to the fifth dimension. In 3 to 4, we're given time, eternity. We're given mobility. We're given eternity in going from 3 to 4.
And
4 to 5, I think it's very similar to imagine a world without sight and be given sight. And that's how profound it was. It was all there. You just couldn't see it before. And I think that then if you were to compare hearing, for example, to going from 5 to 6, you know, all that sound was there. All the benefit of the communication was there, but you just couldn't hear it. All of a sudden, now you can hear it. And that might be the same. But then when you're going from 6 to 7, I don't have a metaphor for that.
These are your concepts. That's true. But they may be, I mean, certainly it's going to be profound. It would be profound just to become an energy-based life form.
Right.
I mean, that's profound. But, see, the thing is, if we're enriched, empowered, you know, to the 10th power, exponentially, as you say. It's like going from a cartoon page to a human being, now from a human being to, you know, well beyond all that. Now we can, and JB and Kirk, I want you guys to agree, we can no longer rely on Craig's stuff.
That's right.
Because
that's
we will have left him in the dust at that point.
Yes, correct. That is correct. And the only thing about that you didn't quite factor in, I will have left me in the dust too.
I'm going to be wherever
we're going to be. It's just that we're all going to be in the same lovely arc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd be willing to bet Craig's still going to be top of the class even in the next
year. Yeah,
No. That is what I'm hoping against. I'm rooting against that.
I just had to take a shot at you, man.
All I want is to be one of the fellas and just to have a grand time out there. And I mean, one of the fellas is inclusive of women who are part of the Covenant family, too.
Yeah.
I just want to be one of them.
Can I point one other thing?
You're already that. We all just chill with you anyway.
You may be smarter than us,
but you're still just one of the guys.
I want to point one other thing out.
Uh-huh.
And it's that the God of Christianity you know, besides being focused on a whole number of issues like love and faith and belief and all these things, is really, really based on every church I ever walked into, focused on salvation.
Right.
And that means he's impotent. And I'm going to tell you why this guy is impotent. And he is definitely impotent. Because we know that thousands find Yahweh's mercy. And since there's billions of Christians out there, and even more than that, well, still billions that believe in God, okay? Because then you can combine a bunch of religions. Yet the salvation is only for thousands. A God focused on salvation is impotent. He's impotent.
Yeah.
He's fairly worthless.
If that was God's primary focus, God's salvation.
You're right. Is impotent because of the fact that 99.999% of people are not going to be saved. So a God that's focused on salvation is not a God that was capable of creating the universe.
Yeah, he's worthless.
God was created. Is capable of creating the universe and is capable of saving anyone is obviously very bad at it. If only 1 in a million people are going to be saved.
Yeah, that's his focus. But that is the focus of Christianity.
If his focus was to save as opposed to create a relationship, why even have salvation? I mean, why not simply say everybody is saved? Which renders it moot. Why not just say everybody is saved if in fact that is your goal? And then if you're going to do that,
pointless otherwise.
Right. The whole thing is pointless.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out how worthless he had to be, assuming we'd have any Christian that could actually make it this far through the show, which is probably not likely. But
no, it's not very likely.
I guess a shot in the dark, you know, type of thing.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
You know, so next week we're going to start on the opening chapter of Yashayahu. There's some really interesting things that, you know, before we even get to the first words, I took some time, and I think I've shared some of this before, but took some time to try to set Yashayahu into a timeline. And you're going to find some very interesting, just like Chabaouk was written 666 years before Paul penned the book of Galatians, the letter to the Galatians, and, of course, what 666 represents. You're going to find a 700 and a 777 that are very important in the timing of Yashayahu. So we're going to spend some time talking about when this was written. And, you know, it's in the realm of 740 BCE, and something really important happened in 33 CE.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and so you can do the math.
I
never bothered to do the math before.
I've never heard that before. Right, another in-your-face type of thing.
Oh, that's just
the
in-your-face
chapter, right?
Yeah, it's opening statements in Yashayahu are written exactly 777 years before they were fulfilled.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then we've got Chabaouk being written 600. You know, there's so much of the Torah, and these are things we're just digging up or, you know, finding out and so forth. There's so many things in the Torah we don't know. You know, I mean, you start throwing that stuff in there. I mean, it's astounding. It really astounds me every time one of them's got
By the way, does it say that it was written 777 years before? No. But you know how
you have to think about it.
I'm speaking to you at the time that this guy was king, and this guy was king, and this guy was king over at Yehuda. And so all you have to do is, because God gave us the timeline and kings and chronicles of when these things happened and who succeeded when and what the timeline was, all you've got to do is say, all right, well, that happens to be, you know, 744 BCE.
740 BCE.
If it's 744 BCE, 745 BCE, well, how many years is that to 33 CE? Just as an interesting
confirmation. 777 years exactly.
Wow.
744. Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
I think there's a significance to that, maybe?
No, no, I'm sure it's not.
No, it's just quick, right?
Another six days it took me.
But that's just part of the whole thing. You know, if you're interested in figuring this stuff out, there are affirmations everywhere, insights everywhere. They're just all over
astounding.
The little pearls.
I mean, it's astounding, and
yeah,
I don't mean to. I'm not just saying that. I'm astounded, and
yeah. You
know what?
Yeah.
The thing that's even more astounding is that the more you find out, and the more that you can share, the less people hear it.
I agree. That, by the way, was why I was telling you that even though, as I'm studying Dode's life in Jerusalem, and he's not speaking directly to Yahweh anymore, but he speaks through the prophets. The prophets then Yahweh conveys through the prophets to Dode that we really have everything we need from Dode. More from Dode would have been counterproductive. So at that point, there is the advantage of him losing his direct contact because God still loved him. God still spoke fabulously of him, still took care of his son, and called him righteous. But, you know, we have ample. We have more than we need from Dode.
Well, you know, it's still... You know, I look forward to this time on the radio. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
And here's why. Yes, there's people I talk to throughout the week on FB, you know, that are covenant family. And yet the only contact I have on a regular basis with anybody that's covenant, honestly, is on the telephone. And,
that's
what I look forward to this
show. Same thing for me.
It's
the same thing for me. And, you know, the question of my youngest son is covenant, and so I get to spend quality time with him in person.
With you every day.
But I'm physically with him, and you occasionally meet with in person with people who are covenant too. But
Rarely, 99%
of my interactions with covenant is by sharing Yahweh's words with him and with one another.
Yeah,
it's just astounding.
Yeah,
I mean we're sitting here with reality. I mean, let's face it, it's reality versus a fabricated reality, right? I mean that's what we're up against here.
Correct.
Okay, and then the reality is that all Yahweh's asking us to do is respond. He's not even asking us to respond perfectly. He just wants us to respond appropriately.
Right.
To respond, which is I think what's appropriate.
Listen to him and respond. Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's not that much I have to do or can do. I mean, I can
wave
the loaves of bread.
You know, what he's asking of us is
that... You wave the loaves of bread in the air? Do you do that? Because I really do that. I literally do that.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, the symbolism is all good. It helps reinforce what it's all about.
Well, it's particularly good if you have kids there. You do it and you explain to them why you're doing it and what it symbolizes. It's a great
message. You know, that's why matzah and Pesach have a specific set of symbols that are associated with them. And by doing those things, you open up a visual a nonverbal means of communicating the message that Yahweh has with those who are witnesses who are open to it.
Oh, well, by the way, I think part of our responding is sharing his words, too. He never specifically tells us to, but he does tell us that those people that, like on Teruah as an example, are people that are
continuing he tells us to share his words all over the time. All over the place. Yeah, he says, you know, post them on the door of your home. When you wake up, share them. When you go to bed, share them. Share them constantly with your children.
Yeah.
He's really explicit on it. Would be really in your interest to know what I said and to share what I said. So no,
that's a big part of the relationship too.
He doesn't order us to, but he encourages us to.
Yeah, he encourages
us to.
He's not
but,
out
you know,
there.
The point is that none of this is a burden.
No, it's not. It's a lot of fun.
Here we're sharing Yahweh's
word. My favorite part of the week
is all we're doing is sharing Yahweh's testimony.
Right, but it's still a sad state of affairs that you can share them with people you care about and nothing really
happens. Yeah.
Their eyes. I see their eyes glaze over and I just go, I'm going to shut up.
Yeah.
It's just.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, most people can't be bothered.
you know, if you don't have a want to, there's nothing you can do about it.
They don't have a want to, nothing to do about it.
They just don't want it.
No.
I mean, they'll go.
No.
They'll go to. There's about 55 scholars in that book. And,
yeah.
And,
you know,
and
one of the things. Yeah, Kurt, that we began, you and I, before the show started recording, and we said, you know, I told you that the number one argument I get, and this is the number one argument I think that people have against yada yada and questioning Paul and intro to God and now observations for our time, is that how can 2.4 billion people be wrong and one person be right? And the answer to that question is when the one person is Yahweh.
It wouldn't matter.
That's how it happens. When the one person is God, it is right, and everybody else is wrong. How it happens. It has. Does it have anything to do with Larry or Kirk or JB?
No.
It's not a vote.
What happens is, how is it possible for one to be right and everyone else be wrong? The answer to that question is the one who is right is Yahweh. That's how it's possible.
Hey, yeah, and also the picture. I mean, come on. You can go from start to finish, and you don't ever have large groups of people with Yahweh. I mean, not ever.
No, ever.
Not even when he takes physical manifestation.
Even when he's got
Yosha,
the children of Israel and going across the wilderness. I mean, they're not a large group of people, and a lot of them fail along the way.
Well, yeah, I mean, look at Abraham. Now, how is it that Abraham responded to Yahweh? Obviously, Yahweh made offers to other people. I think he must have.
No, I don't think so. You know why I don't think so? I just think that Yahweh looked around the planet and said, you know, because he can go forward in time, he's not stuck in time, and he said, you know, that's my guy.
Okay,
I'm not going to force anything on him, but that's my guy, and you know,
Whether you got Noah or whether you got Dode.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Yeah,
or whether you got Abraham.
Basically, it's Dode against the world.
Yeah.
And Noah plus seven.
Yeah, I mean, that's it.
I want to tell you, I mean, how many really intellectual, I understand it, I'm going to proclaim it, were there with Moshe?
None.
You know, occasionally Aaron, but only
Aaron
on occasion.
Aaron occasionally say something, yeah.
Yeah,
but on occasion, Aaron was in opposition. I mean,
on occasion he was. So, you know, so it's never. You know, even one time everybody comes to Moshe and says, Moshe, you can't keep on doing this by yourself. You know, you need help. Okay. So, yeah.
You know, we were Dean Powers and I were talking, and you know, when you got the 70 elders that went up, and you know, it's Jawa, and the secondary notion is to prostrate yourself, and the first one's to make a declaration. You know what it put me to mind of? I mean, these were delusional idiots, is what they amounted to be. Put me to mind the 70 elders of Israel. Of people that pray. They talk at Yahweh.
Yeah.
They don't even listen.
Yeah,
they do. None of them went up there with the intent of listening, apparently.
No. No.
No, they want to tell him all about what they want and what they think he should do.
Yeah.
Guys,
for whatever reason, you know, we're poking fun of me and saying, you know, that I'm going to be smarter than everybody else somehow. Let me tell you something. When it comes to what I know compared to what Yahweh knows, my conversation with Yahweh is for me to tell him what I know. No. Our relationship is he's going to tell me what he knows, and I'm going to listen, and I'm going to enjoy it.
You know something, Craig? You know why I was always comfortable with business types that had really climbed the ladder? You know, you're the first former billionaire I've ever known, but people that were very successful. Is because what I realized about people is none of us know very much more than the next guy. That's the truth.
Right. Yeah, really.
And I'm comfortable with that. I'm really comfortable with that. I'm comfortable with the fact I don't know much.
Yeah.
Now, I have to tell you, from having been around market research, you are probably, you're the best researcher I've ever run across in my life. I mean, that's the truth.
Yeah, I, I don't know if that's the only thing that's unique is that I'm very focused. I come at it from the right perspective, and I know what I'm, you know, because you, once you come to understand, you know what you're looking for, and you just go in to find it. You know, and
yeah, see, and that's your stick. I mean, and you know, but what I'm saying,
that's a pretty good stick.
It is a good stick. And what I'm saying is not a negative. I'm really
like the 777 on the revelation through Yosha to its fulfillment in 33 CE. You know, I went in thinking, you know, I bet you that just because you look at this timing here, I'll bet you that there's going to be some iteration of seven here that's going to be interesting. You know, so I went in looking to find it. I mean, honestly, I went in looking to find it. Okay, and oh, there it is. So is that making a very good research or not? Really, it just means that, you know, that. Yeah,
well, your mind was open also.
You expect to be dazzled.
Your mind was open to finding that.
There's, of course.
You know, you have to actually be thinking along those lines.
You knew you had to
be in the ballpark to start with.
Yeah.
You knew you were in the ballpark. Yeah.
And somebody could say, well, you know, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. You went in looking for it, and you just, you know, found affirmation of what you were looking for. That is true. Stand accused. I went in looking for it, and I found what I was looking for.
But it had to be
you knew Yahweh. This is why you don't read commentaries from people that don't know Yahweh, because they're not getting
exactly
it
right
way.
Right.
You know, along those lines, when I talk to people, I show people color in a painting, and I say, and maybe all these browns or grays, but I say, can you see the red in it? And they say to me all the time, you know, I never would have thought there was red in there, but by God, there it is. You know, I didn't tell you that. It was there. I just told them to observe it.
Yeah. You know, we're one of the things that was interesting in one of the Chronicles things I was translating here this past few days was that there's a passage where Dod is has gathered everybody in Jerusalem together for the purpose of dedicating the arrival of Yahweh's Ark of the Covenant. And then he says, please, and then there are three verbs that follow. And the three verbs could all be translated, bow down. So it's please, bow down, bow down, bow down, if you want to go that route. It's all there for you, and you could take the secondary definition of two of the words and the primary definition of the third, and you could get, if you want to be consistent, bow down, bow down, bow down. Now, why in the world you would take three different words to say bow down three ways would make God verbose. But if you then look at the primary definition of the two words,
you don't know God.
Right. And
go
you
ahead
know
with
Yahweh,
the primary definition.
And what you come up with is something that is really profound. And, you know, when we get to that, I'll share, you know, how you look at these words and how a perspective on who Yahweh is and what he has done for us shapes your rendition of them. And
Yahusha was real clear about the scribes. Now, you know, he had a word for them. Again, it was oil, you know. It is a wild thing that people can go out there and say, yeah, I follow a carpenter from Nazareth. Well, we know he was a stonemason, and his name was Yahusha, but that's okay. They're claiming that they follow the Messiah.
And by the way, there was an interesting tie-in with him being a stonemason, but that only matters if you realize that Yahweh etched his prescriptions for living in stone. What is
in
the
stone? Sure.
Right.
Sure.
To inscribe or to etch in stone the prescriptions for living, and so he was a stonemason. And the part of the stone that is associated with Yosha is the
cornerstone.
Yahweh is unchanging. What he says is the foundation that we stand on with Yahweh, because it is reliable, is established in stone. It's unappropriate.
And I agree with all that.
So there is an
important,
with a stonemason, there is
sure
nothing
is.
That has any value as with a carpenter. Nothing.
Well, see, there again, there you go with Yahweh's nature. And it's just sucks,
I know.
Doesn't it?
I know.
It sucks to be right.
It does.
It unpopular.
It does. You know, so is he a carpenter?
At least
no.
Now.
The stonemason. Yeah. Stone means something. Carpenter doesn't mean squat.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. But I'm just, I'm just saying, you know, woe to the scribes, and then they want to set and do you have any idea? I've put out countless notes on how corrupt King James Version Bibles are, and you will see people that actually want to debate their accuracy when you can show it
right.
side by side.
Right.
Say, what are
right.
you doing here? You know, the Maaseiah said, woe to the scribes, and then you want to uphold the scribes. And that
yeah.
brings us back to the bow down, bow down, bow down, which is not what was said
right.
at all, or praise me,
no.
which is not what was said at all, or any
no.
of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nope. And by the way, what's interesting, at the time that Dode was saying it, Dode was on the outs with Yahweh. I mean, now he was still saved, still part of the covenant, still beloved, but they weren't talking
about him.
He was most certainly not inspired by Yahweh at that point. So if he were to say,
well,
bow down, bow down, bow down, he's the same guy that told a bunch of his soldiers to go out and get him a cup of water from Bethlehem, which was under the control of the Philistines. And when they risked their lives to get him a cup of water from a spring in Bethlehem, he just threw it out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
This is the same guy
know.
At the same time. And so you say, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, well, yeah. Again, the scribes have really twisted Yahweh's nature. They've twisted the plan. They've twisted the hand reaching down into this dimension to people who will respond to him. And that's always the fight we're in, isn't it? I mean, it really
yeah.
is.
And by the way,
over
what, were bringing into, what were they bringing into town? The Ark of the Covenant. What was the Ark? Was it the Ark of the Covenant? So this is the facility that communicates the benefit of the family relationship. And so you're going to bow down to a family? What was it comprised
yeah.
to look like?
Read
a horsey seat? A seat? Are you going to bow down with a chair? I mean, come on.
It's dumb. I couldn't agree with you more. It's stupid.
Right.
But I don't know what you're quoting here, although if it's in Yashayam, I'm going to be back looking at
no,
it.
No, it's just in Chronicles. This is in Chronicles.
Okay, Chronicles. My guess is that, and I haven't seen it, just tell me,
mm-hmm.
it says get on your knees and bow down.
Yeah. Well, it does in the English translation. Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
English translations,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah,
yeah.
But that isn't the what
was being said at all. Of course not.
Okay. Then Dode said to all of those who had gathered for the meeting. So this is 1 Chronicles 29:1. So then, actually, this is probably 20 now because it was Chronicles. I did translated Chronicles 29, well, 1 Chronicles 29:1 all the way through 20. So this may be this is probably the 21st here. Then Dode said to all those who had gathered for the meeting. So they're gathered for a meeting. Now, Yahweh has 7 meetings a year, so we are not told which meeting this one was. But my guess is that it's either Pesach or Sukkah. But anyways, when Dode said to all of those who had gathered for the meeting, please, I implore, I encourage you. So please is not a command. You have ever heard a general say, please do this
please
for me?
Please attack that hill.
Yeah, please attack that hill.
That's a good one, Kirk. Please take that hill. Under machine gun fire.
No, he begins with please. So so that's it starts. And then the next word is Barak. Please bless, choosing of your own accord to greet and to commend, electing to appreciate and adore. Now, please and Barak, it was written in the imperative mood. The imperative mood is the second person volition. So he's speaking to those who have gathered. He's second person volition.
Of your
those who have gathered for the meeting. And so it's their choice. Now, you ever have a general that says, please, of your own accord and free will, take that hill?
No, no.
Please, I want you to want to take that hill.
Yes.
I want you to want.
Choosing of your own accord.
Even better.
To greet, yeah, to greet and commend Yahweh, your God. And all those in the community who had gathered for this reason approached and greeted, commending while continually appreciating and adoring Barak Law, Yahweh, the God of their fathers. And so they were, this is Kadat. Now, so Barak can be, you know, get down on your knees. You know, Yahweh says he Barak'd Adam. He got down on his knees to lift Adam up in love.
Yeah, sure.
So it can mean get down on your knees. So it could be bow down. Although that isn't its primary meaning. It means to greet, to commend, to appreciate, to adore. So that's the first one. The second one is from Kadad, Q-A-D-A-D. And so one of the definitions of Kadad is to incline oneself to be set apart. Kadad is from Kadash, to be set apart. So they were inclined to be set apart, and they made a declaration to this effect, which is chawa. You know, that's the word that the primary meaning means to make a declaration. The secondary meaning means to bow down.
To prostrate yourself.
Right. So they were inclined to be set apart, and they made a declaration to this effect to approach Yahweh and to the king.
That's strong.
And it's really strong, but there are three words for bow down. And if you render them correctly, and then I go through a whole explanation and say, now, if you look these up, this is what you're going to find. And I want you to know why I chose. Why I chose not to say, please. Yeah,
because I know you always
bow down, bow down, bow down.
Bow down, bow down, bow down.
Right.
They bow down in three different ways.
Right.
I'm going to guess that the English translation sounds stupid. I'm just straight up.
Yeah, bless Yahweh and bow down and worship him.
When does it not?
Yeah.
First Chronicles 29:1.
Yep. Yeah. And so we can go through what chawa is, because chawa is really critical to the whole thing. And it does not mean worship. It means to make a declaration. And so we can, and then we need to understand what kadad actually means. I mean, God has lots of words to diminish oneself, to bow down. And kadad means to be inclined.
Sounds like it was taken from Kodesh. You know?
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kodesh, Kadash, whichever one you want to look at, they're all written the same way in Hebrew. It means to be set apart. To be inclined to be set apart. Make a declaration in this regard.
I'm inclined. I'm going to tell you right now.
That's
a good choice.
You know, with what we know, and it's not just about Yahweh's words, but, I mean, Yahweh's words just exemplify it. But about the world and everything, what he says is going to happen is we're watching it happen, and we're watching all the thieves just fight over the crumbs and just diminish a lot of other people. That's what's going to happen. We're watching that. Who would really want to be a part of the fabricated construct that's clearly falling apart? I mean, really?
Really.
I can see where one of them want to be, you know, one of the people that see themselves as the world ruler, you know, or something. But, you know, most people are just going to be part of the unwashed masses. There's not going to be any stratification of the society. There's going to be the super poor and the super elite and nobody else. I mean, in between. That's what they're doing. And that's
correct.
What they'll get done.
Correct.
I know. And so who the hell would want to be?
Rulers would only be the ones that have something, and the rest of them would be scrounging around just trying to survive. So,
well, they don't want to have to answer to anybody, and they want a slave class. I mean, that's the end of it. That's it. That's the whole plan. You know, we tell you what to do, and you do it.
Correct. Yep. Well, the other one's not that way. He's... I'm going to lay it all out. I'd like you to listen to me. I'd like you to carefully consider what I have to say. I'd like you to come to understand it and respond rationally to it. And if you are trying to do those things, then I'll give you everything that is mine to give. Oh, by the way, I've got a lot to give.
Yeah, it's slightly more than faux money.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. Yeah. That's why when people, you know, think they're making donations, they're earning favor with God, you think, God, come on. What does God want with your faux money?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he makes it pretty clear, and I think it was the Michelle 7.
You think that we're going to buy a glass of wine in heaven that we're have to plunk down a $10
a token
note?
Yeah.
Here's $10 token.
Yeah, here's my token.
Here's a token. I want the really good one. I'm going to pay $20.
It gets really stupid. By the way, I got 4 bottles of wine for tomorrow night already. So,
I'm
having a few people over, and I'm doing shish kebabs with beef and also with lamb.
Yeah.
I'm having.
Mix them up. That's exactly right. Yeah, the menu is really
good. Sounds delicious.
Yeah.
Oh, it'll be good. Oh, it'll be absolutely excellent. Be absolutely excellent, I guarantee it. But that's what I'm doing. And having wine, and I got my bread, and I'm making some potato salad with it and a couple other things, and it's going to be a good one.
Yeah. You're going to have a good time.
Speaking of food, I might have to let you guys go. I'm getting hungry.
Yeah.
I can smell the lasagna from here, man.
Yeah, good night, y'all. All right.
We'll see you guys next week.
Craig?
Oh, yes. Kirk, I don't know what we're going to do.
Are we getting back together next Friday, or are we going to get together during the week?
I don't know when we're, I figured, let Scott, my only comment to Scott was, go enjoy your wedding. When you get back in next week, let us know what works for you. And if we just skip a week, it's not the end of the world. And if we... So let's just see what would work best. The thing that I don't want to ever do is make it so that it's a burden for Scott. Yeah, it's a job.
No.
So it's just got to be relaxed and easy. And if it's relaxed and easy and there's a time next week, even if it means that I go it alone for one, it's not the end of the world, you know? I wasn't saying it from that perspective, but if he has a Tuesday, I can't do Thursday. If he has a Tuesday and you're teaching, and he wants to do it, rather than saying no, I'll probably just go and do it. And if but I don't know that at this point. I just said relax. Let's talk about it next week.
All righty, buddy.
So at this point, I can't say anything. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoy your Sabbath.
Bye-bye, JP.